Hi there, and welcome to the Living with SMA podcast. We're here to have conversations about living with spinal muscular atrophy. Throughout this podcast, we will be covering lots of different topics, from preparing for university, getting the most from your personal budget, sex and relationships, and lots more. So we invite different hosts from across the SMA community to come together here. We want to answer your questions, provide you with useful tips and recommendations, and also share personal stories. So please do reach out and connect with us here at the charity SMA UK. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find the podcast useful.
Hey there, thank you ever so much for tuning into this episode of the SMA podcast. I'm Toby Milden, and I was diagnosed with SMA type 2 when I was about 1 or 2 years old. I'm now in my 40s. I've just moved to Manchester, having spent almost 20 years living in London. I live with my boyfriend in Manchester. And today I'm joined by a fellow floppy. I don't know if you've heard of that term, but a friend of mine who's got SMA refers to us as floppies. But Andy Thornton, who's also got SMA. Andy, it's lovely to chat with you today.
Likewise, Herbie. Good to see you.
So, Andy, what's your background?
Well, no, I haven't heard the phrase floppy before. I've been referred to by many things in my lifetime, but floppy is not one of them. My name's Andy Thornton. I know we're talking about SMA in our 40s today, but I've entered my 40s and almost in my 50s now. I'm 47 years old. I live in Cambridge, and I work for the NHS and have done for about 25 years. I'm head of their outpatient department in Cambridge University Hospitals. So it's quite an entertaining role. And I'm married, no kids, 6 dogs. And we were one of those that got a lockdown puppy. Sir Bernard. Which is crazy. It's the biggest dog I've ever had. And I've got the scratches to show to prove it. And I've been married for, I think, 27 years, 28 years now. We actually met just when I was finishing school. All very dodgy. She worked for the school as a carer in junior school. So we met when I was at school.
So, Andy, you and I are both involved in SMA organisations because I'm a trustee of SMA UK, and I've been involved with the charity for ages, because when it was the Jennifer Trust, I used to go to the family conferences with my parents, and then I became a trustee when I was at university, and I've just been involved with the charity because you're involved in an SMA organisation as well, aren't you?
I am. I'm a trustee of Treat SMA. It's interesting because I wasn't really involved in any kind of SMA organisations or charities or anything really. I feel I grew up in this world where I never really knew what things were out there. And it wasn't really until that we started seeing treatments being talked about that I really started to pay any notice. And that's when I kind of bumped into the guys from Treat SMA and I joined them.
Cool. So obviously the topic of today's conversation is living with SMA in our 40s. What's your experience of living with SMA in the fourth decade?
Yeah, and considering I'm almost in my fifth decade as well. I guess things are changing. I've got to say, when I was younger, I've been relatively fortunate with SMA. I was a strong type 2, so I didn't really have, I've always been in a wheelchair, hence why I'm a type 2, but I was quite fortunate that I led quite an active life in my younger years, and kind of almost ignored the fact that I had SMA. It was just disabled. I didn't really think about the whole deterioration side of things. Wasn't really until I got into my, or probably my 30s, that I really started to notice things going in the wrong direction. And you know, it's tough. I've said it before. SMA is obviously tough physically, but mentally it's challenging as well. You know, I've worked, as I said, for 25 years. As I've worked in the NHS, I've changed jobs. As I've been doing jobs, I've lost the ability to do certain things. You know, for example, I started answering telephones, and now I couldn't pick up a telephone. You know, and it's, so I think it's challenging. But at the same time, you get, life is what you make it, regardless of what you've got or the what condition you have or anything else. You can always make a difference. And I think I've always prided myself in, I always wanted a career. I always wanted to be as normal as I could be. And, you know, I've done things like, I've been kicked out of university from being bad. I've lived abroad. So, you know, it's quite an interesting lifestyle.
Now I'm intrigued about why you got kicked out of uni.
I some of you may know about it, but there was a special, well, it's college really, a special,
I've heard of it.
And I went there, it's kind of a residential college. I went there when I was 16. And I, the weird environment, it's like being locked up in some kind of, I don't know, prison or kind of asylum center or something like that. I was going to the mainstream college because back in my day, we all went to, I don't know if you were the same, but we went to special schools. We were never really integrated into mainstream schools. But
yeah,
this was the first time I'd been integrated, and I went to the local college to do A levels, and you know, regardless of whether or not you had lectures, you were up at 7, you had breakfast at 8. You were in your room for the best part of the day, even if you didn't have any work to do. They wanted you to study, which was a bit weird. There was a curfew, and I'd not long met my wife, who was then my girlfriend, and she was coming up to see me regularly. And the last thing I was going to be doing was having a curfew at 6 o'clock in the evening. You know, I want to go to the pub and you know, have fun. And I just didn't play by the rules. And I was asked to leave after about a year. So always been a bit of a rebel.
Because I went to a special school as well. But I think because there's a bit of a gap between us. Like, you're at the end of the 40s. I've just turned 40. And like, when I went to school, I grew up in the West Country near Glastonbury. The local secondary school to me, that the head teacher actually said to my parents that he didn't want disabled children in his school. I think this was just before the Disability Discrimination Act came into effect. So I went to a school that was about 20 miles from home, which was a Barnardo's special school. But just as I was about to start my GCSEs, Barnardo's had this policy of integrating disabled children into mainstream schools. So I did my GCSEs at a kind of quote unquote normal secondary school, which is a brand new building. So it was really wheelchair accessible. Barnardo's kind of had like a outreach service, you know, within the school. So I did my GCSEs there, and then I went to a sixth form college before going on to university in the Midlands. But yeah, it's quite shocking, really, because I don't know the number of kids with SMA nowadays that would go to a special school. I'm assuming, I don't know if you know, but I'm assuming the majority of SMA kids go to like a mainstream school.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty standard now. A lot of mainstream schools have a kind of support stroke vocational element to them as well, so they can support people with disabilities for any sort of special requirements that they have. But I mean, yeah, that's the challenge with SMA. We can be quite severely disabled physically, but there's as bright as a button intellectually. Yeah. So we're in a weird place. And, you know, back in my day, it was very much you went to a special school. I mean, at one point in my class, there was three people. There was only 100 students in the entire school. So you didn't get the same level of exposure. And I think it's much better now because, and it's similar to the work environment as well. You know, now people with SMA get exposed to, in quotes, normal life. If I could lift my arms up, I'd do the little quote sign, but
yeah.
But likewise, kids, adults now get exposed to people with SMA as well. And I think that's one of the humbling things from work. I mean, I have a lot of people that on a day-to-day basis, I'm responsible for about 500 people. And, you know, a fair chunk of them have learned a lot about my condition and, you know, have got involved in the charity stuff and supported the campaigning for treatment and all that kind of stuff. So I've actually taught them some things as well, which is nice.
What are some of the most common questions that you get asked by colleagues interested in SMA?
I think because I've been fairly heavily focused on it for the last few years, then a lot of people have asked me about, you know, with the treatments, they see news headlines about Zolgensma and other things and ask general queries about, you know, how does it work, what causes it and things like that. Yeah. And I think I've always been quite open and honest about my disability. I have no issue. I'm one of the worst people for being politically correct. So, you know, I take the mick out of myself just as I take the mick out of anybody else, and I wouldn't expect anybody to do it be any different with me. So I think it's the kind of questions, as I said, now are what is SMA, which is great. But more generally, you know, I'm asked, you know, the usual questions: do you need a license to drive that? And all of that kind of crap that you think, oh, yeah, you're the first person that's asked me that ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, how fast can you go in that thing? Careful, don't run over my feet, will you?
I know. And you know, I have this tendency to aim for people's feet when they ask me that. But I have a fairly open relationship with all of my colleagues at work, and they can pretty much ask me anything. And I think they learn as they go rather than ask me any particular questions. I think the hardest thing is getting over that stigma of you're in a wheelchair, therefore you're not as clever. And I think even though people know that you are, there will always be those people that kind of look down on you, both literally and metaphorically.
But it sounds like you've done well in the health service. Like, if you're managing a team of 50 people, 500, sorry, I missed a zero. But if you're managing, that is a lot of response. That is a big management job. And I mean, do you think that changes people's perceptions of you?
I think it does. I think they see you, that they don't see, as you get sort of higher up in the organization or you take on more responsibility, the wheelchair gets smaller, I think. And yeah, I always remember I got a promotion at one point in my job, and I was sitting in my boss's office. We were having a natter, and occupational health rang him up while I was in the office. And I just landed, you know, it was a good middle management position. And they said to him, well, do you know he's disabled? And I'd worked for this guy for the best part of 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, so there is still this, there was still this air of acknowledgement of the disability rather than the person. But I think, you know, as you move through your career, I've definitely found that the wheelchair's got smaller. And I always say that, you know, the more responsibility you have, the less actual work you do. They employ me for my leadership now as opposed to my physical prowess. So
yeah,
you know, that's all pretty good.
Which I suppose is quite good, because if you physically can't do less, like you mentioned, you used to answer the phones. Like that's how I started. My first job was answering phones. I used to work for a bank, and in the days of checkbooks, I used to sit there like putting checks through a machine, processing these checks. Like I couldn't do that now. I can't even lift a pencil.
No, I'm the same.
Yeah. So if anyone does want to give me a job, it has to be because I'm an exceptional leader and I've got a brilliant brain.
Yeah.
Not because I'm going to lift anything.
Yeah. Or the sense of humor.
Yeah. And everyone with SMA has got a really good sense. Well, I was going to say really good, but I think it's like a warped sense of humor. Have you, like, you know, you mentioned treatments. Are you on any treatments?
Yeah, I am. I'm on Risdiplam. Are you also?
Yeah, I started Risdiplam about 3 or 4 months ago. Okay. How about you?
I started on the 22nd of December.
Cool.
It was a great Christmas present.
How
are you finding it since you've started?
I don't notice any difference, if I'm honest.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I feel like I just have this like little burst of energy, and I've managed to move my hand from my knee onto my wheelchair controller, which is very difficult for me to do, but it happens like very occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, how about you? Have you noticed anything?
No, and I think I'm kind of similar to you. I've probably noticed slightly less fatigue. And I was getting quite, I don't know about you, but I was getting quite frustrated with not seeing some of the improvements that others talk about. You know, I've seen people make some really quite outlandish claims after being on it for a week you know, physiologically it's impossible. It just means that they could do that thing before, they just weren't trying. And I think it's that placebo effect that you get with some of these treatments that people were talking about. But I mean, I had my first assessment at hospital earlier this week, and despite being convinced that I hadn't really seen any improvement, my core strength had increased slightly, my dexterity had increased slightly, and my lung capacity had increased slightly.
Oh, brilliant.
So, you know, and hopefully you'll see the same thing in sort of another, are you presumably you're having 6 monthly checks, are you? Or
yeah, because I'm not, I haven't been on the drug for 6 months yet. Yeah. So I'll be having, I've got that to look forward to, but I've also, because I moved from London to Manchester, I've also had to move my sort of healthcare and social care packages around. So I was under St George's Hospital in London, and now I've just moved up to Manchester, one of the Manchester hospitals.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there are any problems, let me know. I know the chief exec of the Manchester group, so.
I was going to say, you're a good contact to have, given that you're a manager of 500 people within the health service. It's quite good. And it, actually, you know, because that was quite a challenge for me, actually, moving everything around. You know, what's your health care package or your social care package like?
My health care and social care package is nothing. Right. So that's pretty easy to explain. my wife is my sole carer, always has been. I guess that's part of the old school way, you know, these packages weren't available. And now, I mean, me and my wife have talked about it, whether or not we wanted to explore having some help. But to be honest, it would feel weird. I'm not quite sure how I would get used to having strangers in the house and all of that kind of stuff when you've been doing something for so long. I mean, how about yourself? Because, I mean, you've obviously adapted to having that kind of care package.
Yeah, because I've actually got a 24-hour care package. I count myself as very fortunate because when I was 16 and I was moving from college to university, I had a social worker, like the best social worker I've ever had. I've got some horror stories of social workers, but she was like the best social worker I've ever had, who helped me get my kind of first care package together. And I think the reason why she was so good is because she was disabled herself. Mm-hmm. So she knew, I don't know if this is the politically thing correct thing to say, basically she knew how to work the system.
Yeah.
And she was also thinking kind of years ahead. I think her mindset was like, let's try and get like the best care package that we can now, because it's harder to kind of take things away than add to it in the future. So I've ended up with, you know, a 24-hour care package. But as I said earlier, I live with my partner in Manchester, but I suppose we're quite clear between like what his role is in my care as well. So neither of us want him to do any care for me because we want to keep things separate. Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, he does do stuff for me. So like, you know, he feeds me at dinner time in order for us to have time together. Mm-hmm. You know, if we go out to a restaurant together, you know, he'll feed me so we don't have to take a carer with us. So we found our groove, I think. Yeah.
And how long have you been together?
We've been together 5 years.
Right.
We met through work. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you met your wife ages ago, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Murderers get less time. we met when I was just finishing up school. So that's what, 30 plus years ago now. We've been married for 27 years, I think. We're at that point now where I'm never entirely sure how many years it is, but occasionally I get reminded. I guess the difference there is that because I've never had that kind of care package, and I've been with my wife since effectively year dot, it feels like, it just feels odd if I was to then have carers, whereas I guess because you've always had them, like since you said, since you were sort of 20 odd years now, and obviously your partner has come into it with you already having that, and therefore acknowledges that you've had it at the beginning of the relationship, I think it would just be weird. Now, I mean, I'm sure there'll come a time that we'll have to think about it. But at the moment, we're both in relatively good health and there's no issues. So it just would feel a bit odd. There are times then I wish that, you know, I had a carer or someone that I could, a PA or someone that I could use rather than my wife. But it would just feel weird now.
Yeah. And I was interested, like you mentioned earlier, around kind of like the mental health side of having SMA. What's your experience has been on that front?
I think it's tough. I think sometimes the mental element of it is more severe than the physical side of it. Yeah, it's really difficult, and I don't think it gets enough recognition. I mean, I'm as a trustee for Treat SMA, I'm also involved in the Risdiplam NICE appraisal that we're going through at the moment.
Yeah,
you know, it's all about the utility and qualities of being able to do things. You know, there's very little taken into account around the mental element of SMA, and as I said, it's huge, particularly when you are a type 2 and a type 3, because you know you've experienced things that you can do that you now can't do. So you know, it's almost like I guess if someone probably not the most PC thing to say, but you know, if you're injured in an accident and you lose the ability to walk, that happens once. And, you know, you have to get used to the fact that you can no longer walk. But you only have to do that once. Whereas in our position, we're having to do that over and over and over again throughout our lives. And that, I don't necessarily think people put it into that context.
I think it's having to go through that kind of grieving and loss process, really, isn't it? You know, from a psychological perspective. Because I mean, I don't know about you, but I've had years of psychotherapy, and I've had to do it privately because the mental health support that's provided through the health service, it isn't robust enough, in my opinion. And in fact, I didn't go into therapy because of any particular SMA related reasons. I went into it because I've got a family history of, you know, mental illness, and I was really concerned about my own psyche. And I thought, you know, at the time I had a job in the city, a really well paid job in the city, and I thought, you know, I'm in a privileged position to be able to pay for psychotherapy privately, so I'm just going to do it because I think it will help my, you know, help me and my quality of life. But I had a huge sort of setback and that sense of loss in 2010 when I got pneumonia. And I spent 3 months in hospital. Two of those months were in intensive care. I was in a coma for a month. And in hindsight, before that episode, I was a relatively strong type 2 SMA. Mm-hmm. I could lift a pint of beer by myself, mm-hmm. which meant I could go out independently for a short amount of time to have dinner with friends and family. I could go to work semi-independently. I could drive an adapted car, and all of that just disappeared overnight. And in hindsight, actually, I don't think I gave myself much of a break in terms of processing that, you know, that loss.
And I think that I've always been quite what's the word, blasé about the psychological side of SMA until, ironically, I joined Treat SMA and I started to understand, you know, I lived in my own bubble, basically. I didn't really mix with other people who were disabled or had conditions other than, you know, through work. If I had a member of staff who had a physical disability or condition that needed to be managed, I just didn't really engage in that whole disability environment. And I think I just never really, I never really thought of it, but actually being part of Treat SMA and having conversations with other people, with SMA and parents and so forth, you really do start to evaluate yourself and how you feel about things. And I've been relatively fortunate. I've been fairly healthy. I've never been into hospital, apart from a spinal fusion, and I broke a leg in a car accident at one point. They're the only two times I've ever been in hospital. But I've had to, I've gone through exactly the same things that you're talking about, perhaps maybe not at one time though. You know, I lost the ability to lift a pint, and you know, I would try and hide that fact by just not going to the pub. And then you get to the point where, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm just going to have to accept that someone's going to help me. And then, you know, you lose the ability to feed. And then you think, oh, no, you know, I'm going to hide that by not going to office functions or parties or whatever. You know, so you're constantly going through that reassessment of your position in your life and society. And that's really tough.
Yeah, because I think I just wish that more attention was paid to, like, the psychological well-being of SMA, just as so much attention is paid to, like, you know, the physical well-being.
I agree.
Yeah, because it's like, it's just having that kind of rounded approach to well-being, really.
And funnily, I mean, conversations like this, I know we're recorded and other people are going to hear this. Well, I hope other people are going to hear it. We've bored them to tears by now. You know, having conversations like this is actually really quite refreshing. And as I said, up until a few years back, I would never have dreamed of doing something like this. You know, last week I did a radio interview about SMA and things like that. So it's been an eye opener. This whole thing is, I've learned more about my own condition and more about myself in the last 3 or 4 years than I think I had in the previous 40 odd years.
I've always been a fan of sort of personal development. You know, my boyfriend takes the piss out of me sometimes for having all these like motivational books on the bookshelf. You know, and it's like, I don't know, I've always been interested in it, and I've always valued having a network of SMA brothers and sisters around me as well. Like, you know, I remember when, you know, I went to one of the, you know, the JTSMA, what was, it's now SMA UK, but when it was first set up in 1981, it was called the Jennifer Trust for SMA, but went to one of the family conferences, and I remember there was this lady there who has SMA. Don't know how old she was, but anyway, she was older than me, but she was like, oh, you should start thinking about putting in your application for a motability car because you could drive. And I was like, really? I can drive? And I didn't know that I would be able to drive an adapted car. And if it wasn't for having that kind of connection, I might not be able to, I might not have driven and had that independence.
And I think that's exactly the same as me, in the sense that I didn't have that network, and I've clearly missed out over the years of not doing things that perhaps I could have done had I had that knowledge. It definitely speaks volumes of actually having that network of people in the same position as you. But I guess I spent most of my life trying to deny that I had a disability, certainly the first half of my life. You know, I was determined to almost ignore it and just, you know, move on, and not acknowledging it felt like a weakness. I think all of those things, you know, have a psychological element to them. That just, as you say, isn't addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me, one of my favorite books is called The Velvet Rage, and it's written by an American psychologist, and he talks about growing up gay in a world that's been designed by straight men. Yeah. And when I read the book, I was like, actually, you could substitute the word gay for disabled, and yeah, it would be about growing up disabled in a world that's been designed by non-disabled people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's maybe why we, yeah, a lot of people become, a lot of people with SMA are actually high achievers.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a track record of high achievers within our elite club. You know, I think it is because, you know, we've had to work hard at overcoming obstacles and things like that.
No, I agree. It's and that's, you know, that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing for us. But I mean, you know, equally, I've had really good relationships with able-bodied people by being able to, by not almost acknowledging that I'm disabled, you know. And I got into this mindset that if I don't acknowledge it, then nobody else will acknowledge it. But again, it's only been the last few years that I've been able to reflect on my own attitudes and my own feelings towards disabilities by having conversations like this with people who have been ahead of me on that curve of kind of understanding and acknowledging.
Yeah, definitely. So I think as we come to the end of our conversation today, like, what would you say to your 18-year-old self if you could write him a letter?
Make sure you don't have any pictures taken with your mullet. as you can see, the mullet doesn't exist anymore. I think if I was going to say anything, it would be more realistic and be more accepting of who you are, and, you know, that the fact that you are, in quotes, different, you know, don't try to hide that or ignore it. You know, kind of embrace it, and, you know, and learn to live with it rather than kind of denying it and trying to learn to live with it by denying it, if that makes sense. And I think, you know, there's I think that would have made life a lot easier, because I think half of my battle when I was younger was, you know, my desire to try and push it to one side. Every now and again I'd lose a function, and I'd end up in this position where I'm almost fighting with myself. You know, one part of me is saying, I can't do this anymore. And the other part of me saying is, no, stupid, of course you can. You know, so I think that's probably, and as I said, absolutely the mullet. What about yourself?
I think my letter would say something like, you know, dear Toby, be kind to yourself. Give yourself a break. You're doing the best that you can.
I think that
would be my advice.
I think that's fair enough. It's also about having ambitions as well, isn't it? I mean, I always knew when I was growing up I wanted to be a manager. I don't know, a manager of what? I had no idea, but I wanted to be a manager. I don't know what that meant. You know, most people come up with exciting things like an astronaut. I knew I couldn't be an astronaut. But, you know, I think it's about having ambitions as well, and not letting the condition define you. You know, and that for me has always been, as I said, I'll probably be taking it too far the other way in some ways. But, you know, I've been fortunate. I haven't had any serious chest infections, touch wood, since I was about 16. You know, so 30 odd years. So I've been in relatively good health. It's easy to think like that when you've been in relatively good health.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Andy, I've really enjoyed talking with you today.
Likewise. We must do it again, only maybe not recorded.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, we should do it down the pub.
Absolutely.
And we'll bring our set of straws, because neither of us can lift a pint glass to our mouths anymore, so we'll come equipped with straws. And but yeah, I think next time we should just hang out down the pub. But it's been a really great conversation with you today, and hopefully the person listening to our chat hasn't tuned out, and you know they've enjoyed it as well. So thanks for joining me today, Andy.
No problem. Just one other thing I will just say before I go, and this I kind of, it's almost like a public message. You know, we talked about treatment earlier on. If people are listening to this and people are on treatment and they're frustrated by the feeling that the treatment isn't working, have faith. You know, these treatments work with everybody differently. Yeah. Don't lose faith. It will be doing something. And just focus on your own progression rather than everybody else's that you see on all of these blogs and everything else. I think, you know, that's another major mental health issue there, because people spend too much time thinking about why aren't they doing something that someone else can, as opposed to focusing on what they can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's great advice. Thanks, Andy. Thank
you. No worries.
I've certainly taken that on board.
All right, mate. No worries. Good to talk to you.
All right. Cheers. See you later. And thank you for tuning in and listening to Andy and me. And we'll see you soon. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Living with SMA podcast. We hope you can join us again next time. But in the meantime, please don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can find out more on our website at smauk.org.uk.